Good evening. Go ahead and open your Bibles to the book of Lamentations. The fifth lament specifically, you might go ahead and open up there. That's going to be the place we're going to be studying here this evening. We've been considering over the last month or so at various points in time the book of Lamentations. And we've pointed out throughout that the book of Lamentations is comprised of five laments, a specific kind of poem even, in which the poet mourns Israel's destruction and exile. And each lament, we pointed out, is an acrostic poem, which means that the first letter of each line begins with the successive letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So you can go, if you go to the Hebrew text, if you're ever interested in learning the Hebrew alphabet, go find the book of Lamentations, and you can just follow your finger down the first of each of these lines, and you'll find the Hebrew alphabet in order. And that's true across the board, with the exception of this fifth lament. The fifth lament is not an acrostic poem. The fifth lament does not have each first letter of the Hebrew alphabet at the beginning of each line, but interestingly enough, the fifth lament does contain exactly 22 lines, which is the number of letters in the Hebrew alphabet. Each lament ends with a prayer. That's another thing we've pointed out about these laments. The first lament, the second lament, the third lament, they all end with a prayer, except for the fourth lament and the fifth lament. The fifth lament is entirely a prayer to God, and it seems to serve sort of as the prayer that we might initially have thought to tack on to the end of the fourth lament. And so in that way, we have these two poems that stand apart from the rest. These features about this poetry, these features about this book, the acrostic nature of the book, but not the fifth psalm, the fifth lament. The idea that all of the other laments, with the exception of the fourth, contain a prayer at the end, but the fifth is entirely a prayer to God. All of these elements about the fifth lament lead us to understand that perhaps this fifth lament is set aside to be something unique. It's a unique conclusion for the book as a whole. And so we're going to consider that fifth lament here tonight. But before we do that, I don't want you to forget what we've already explored in this book, what things have already been said here. The first lament, you may recall, mourned Israel's condition, as the other laments have as well, but specifically the first lament highlighted the point that sin was to blame for Israel's suffering. Why are we suffering? Well, it's because we've sinned before God. It's because we have taken God's covenant and shattered it. And so God has brought upon us a kind of punishment. The second lament continued mourning for the city of Jerusalem and for the condition of Israel, but it did not focus on the sin of God's people. Rather, it focused on the fact that God was actually to blame for the suffering, that God is actually the one who is the consuming fire that has his thumb pressed against his people in this moment. The third lament found the poet at his lowest point, in a position of utter hopelessness. Even so, even despite him coming to the point where he found no reason to hope, even despite that, he remembered God's character in the third lament. He remembered that God was faithful, that God was merciful, that God was full of loving kindness, and despite reaching that all-time low, the poet was filled with a renewed kind of hope. The fourth lament returned to the mourning of the first and second lament. The fourth lament sounded almost identical to the first and second laments in the kinds of things it talked about, in the idea that sin brought about the suffering, in the idea that God is the one imposing this suffering. But in the fourth lament, the poet is able to look at his suffering through the renewed perspective provided by his understanding of God's nature. Now, in the fourth lament, the poet can have hope through his suffering because he knows about his God and his God's character. The fifth lament, then, serves as a fitting conclusion to the book that we have before us. The issue of suffering is not resolved here. If you thought we would get to the end of the book of Lamentations and we would have some happy thoughts to kind of go away with, you've come to the wrong place. We don't find any resolution to the suffering that's happening here in this condition. There's no resolution to the larger story of Israel's captivity in this book. This book leaves us in much the same place that we began, with Israel suffering greatly, Jerusalem suffering greatly at the hand of God and their enemies. But the author demonstrates in this last lament, and really I think this is the point of Lamentations as a whole, the author demonstrates the right attitudes to have during suffering and the right actions to take while suffering. In other words, this book doesn't teach us how to overcome suffering. It teaches us how to suffer. It teaches us how to suffer in a way that is pleasing to God and in a way that honors God. So what is the message then of this fifth lament? I pointed out to you that this fifth lament is entirely a prayer to God. There really is no lamenting in the sense that we've seen in the other laments, where the poet will just, you know, as if talking to a crowd or as if talking to an audience, will bemoan his situation. This lament is entirely directed towards God. And he pleads for mercy to begin with. The first 10 verses is the poet just pleading for mercy before his God. In Lamentations chapter 5, look there at verse 1. "Remember, O Lord, what has befallen us. Look and see our reproach. Our inheritance has been turned over to strangers, our houses to aliens. We have become orphans without a father. Our mothers are like widows. We have to pay for our drinking water. Our wood comes to us at a price. Our pursuers are at our necks. We are worn out. There is no rest for us. We have submitted to Egypt and Assyria to get enough bread. Our fathers sinned and are no more. It is we who have borne their iniquity. Slaves rule over us. There is no one to deliver us from their hand. We get our bread at the risk of our lives because of the sword in the wilderness. Our skin has become as hot as an oven because of the burning heat of famine." Now there, of course, is a lot of things that we sound familiar to us as well, because he is describing the suffering, but he's doing so as a plea to God for mercy. Right there in verse 1, you notice that the author begs God to remember him, begs for God's attention. The very thought there that God would remember them is the request made before the poet recalled God's great mercy in chapter 3, in the third lament. When the poet had reached utter despair and he said, "I have no longer any hope in God," it was in chapter 3 and verse 19 that the poet said, "God, remember me." And then, of course, the poet is caused to remember God, and he remembers God's mercy. But he says, "Remember, O Lord, what has befallen us. Look upon us with mercy. Look and see our reproach," the second line says. This call to look and see is reminiscent of the poet's prayer in the first two laments. In fact, that's almost verbatim what he says in chapter 1, verse 20, and chapter 2, verse 20. After mourning his position, he comes down to the end of those laments and offers a prayer, and his prayer is the same prayer he offers here. "Look and see our reproach." At the beginning of this, it seems like he's just regurgitating the same kinds of prayers he's offered before. When suffering, God's people need God's attention more than ever before. That God would look down on us, that God would remember our plight, and that's what the poet asks for. But then in verses 2 through 10, after this initial request for God to look upon him, to remember him, he enumerates the things that he wants God to remember, the things he wants God to look at, and the things he wants God to see. In other words, what we find in verses 2 through 10 are the things that the poet wants God to see. And there's a lot of things in here in verses 2 through 10. But I want you to look at an idea that recurs again and again and again in these nine verses. Look at verse 2. "Our inheritance has been turned over to strangers, our houses to aliens." He says that all that they are, all that they have, is now in a stranger's possession, in the possession of foreigners, right? Skip down to verse 4. Look what comes again. He says, "We have to pay for our drinking water. Our wood comes to us at a price." There's some kind of servitude going on here. All that they possess is now given to strangers, and the things that they freely had, they're now being charged, presumably by these strangers, these foreigners. They're now being charged for these things that were free to them to use earlier. We see the same kind of thing in verse 9 when he says, we get our bread at the risk of our lives because of the sword in the wilderness. We're going out and we're trying to attain these kinds of necessities of life, but the prices are too high, right? We can't buy it. We have to go out into the wilderness. And even there we find danger and suffering. Why? Because these strangers are imposing themselves on us. Look at verse 5. Our pursuers are at our necks. We are worn out. There is no rest for us. The poet describes that there are people who are actively pursuing them. Verse 6 describes that they had submitted to Egypt and Assyria to get enough bread. This is something that we read about in Jeremiah's writings and in some of the other prophets, where they were accused of going not to God for safety or for relief, but they went to Egypt, they went to Assyria, thinking that the might of nations could help them, but they went there and they found no help. In verse 8, it says that slaves rule over us. We're no longer our own people. In fact, how low has Israel sunken? They're not masters over slaves now. No, now they are ruled over by slaves themselves. They're not even slaves to masters, right? They're slaves to slaves. That just shows you how low they've sunk. I want you to notice here that a couple of things that I've pointed out. But the primary concern here is that Israel relied on the nations around them instead of God. That seems to be the primary kind of concern. We are now being given over into the hands of strangers. We are ruled by slaves. We are pursued by people. They are imposing these high prices on us so that we can't live. We have the necessities that we've submitted to Egypt and Assyria, right? You see how that recurs over and over and over. Look at that, God. Look at what's happened. Look at what we've been reduced to. Of course, this has always been a problem for Israel. There in verse 7, up in verse 6, he says, we've submitted to Egypt and Assyria to get enough bread. He says, our fathers sinned and are no more. It is we who have borne their iniquity. This notion that we can rely on the nations around us to survive, to have the kind of things we need, the kind of safety we need, this has always been a struggle for Israel. They've always encountered this where they try to go to the nations around them, to be like the nations around them, to lean on the nations around them, and it's always ended poorly. And now they're finally, this generation is finally reaping the consequences of all of those poor choices. And so the poet turns to God, like he did in verse 1, and says, remember, O Lord, what has befallen us. Remember what we're going through. Remember how we've come away from this land and how we've been torn from this land and how we're taken and we're ruled over by slaves and strangers and Egypt and Assyria left us, you know, with no safety, no relief. The poet describes this plea for mercy. Please, God, be merciful to us because we've messed up. That's really what he gets into in verse 11 and 18, 11 through 18, rather. He describes the other consequences for their sins. He says, because we've let ourselves go into these nations, because we've turned to these nations for relief when we should have turned to God, there are certain consequences that we live with. He says, they ravished the women in Zion, the virgins in the cities of Judah. Princes were hung by their hands. Elders were not respected. Young men worked at the grinding mill, and youths stumbled under loads of wood. Elders are gone from the gate, young men from their music. The joy of our hearts has ceased. Our dancing has been turned into mourning. The crown has fallen from our head. Woe to us, for we have sinned. Because of this, our heart is faint. Because of these things, our eyes are dim. Because of Mount Zion, which lies desolate, foxes prowl in it. The poet highlights that Israel has sinned by trusting in nations instead of in their God. And consequently, the nations have imposed certain things upon them, have imposed their will upon Israel. Verse 11, they've ravished the women. They've raped the women in the city. They've done horrible, horrible things to our people. The leaders of Israel have been humiliated. In verse 12, the princes are hung by their hands. The elders are not respected. Those who should have a place of high honor in Israel are not given that place any longer. They're humiliated. The young men in verse 13, the strong men, they were enslaved. They were put heavy labors on their backs. They're taken into slavery. All happiness, all joy, all pleasantries have been stripped from the land. There is no dancing. There's no singing. There's no rejoicing. This is the consequences for sins. Woe to us, for we have sinned, verse 16. And certainly they had. They had turned away from the gracious, merciful, and loving God and turned to the harsh nations for comfort. They had God telling them, look to me. I will be your king. I will be your guide. I will take you in. And they went after Egypt. And they went after Assyria. And they're reaping the punishments for those choices. The poet reiterates, in case you forgot, that their sins have caused all of this suffering. Because of this, what? Because we have sinned, our heart is faint. Because of these things, our eyes are dim. Because of Mount Zion, which lies desolate, foxes prowl in it. But then the concluding verses of this lament are a plea for restoration. Finally, the poet asks for something we haven't heard him ask for yet at all in the book. We have not yet heard the poet ask for God to do anything other than just notice them. We haven't heard the poet ask for any kind of restoration or any kind of relief. And I don't know about you, but that shocks me. That it takes the very last four verses of the book to get down where the poet finally says, God, do something about it. The first thing I pray for when I confront any kind of suffering, right, is, you know, God, take it away. God, get rid of it. And yet the poet doesn't do that, at least not initially. The poet has withheld this request for the very end of the book. Probably because this is what everybody's going to leave knowing, right? When you preach a lesson, when you do any kind of public speaking, save the most important thing for last. Because that's what people are going to walk out remembering. That seems to be what he's doing here. This is the most important thing in the whole book, right here in these four verses. This is why he's waited till the very end. He hasn't even hinted at this throughout the book. And finally, he's going to beg God to restore their position. And I want you to notice what he does here. Verse 19. You, O Lord, rule forever. Your throne is from generation to generation. Why do you forget us forever? Why do you forsake us so long? Restore us to you, O Lord, that we may be restored. Renew our days as of old, unless you have utterly rejected us and are exceedingly angry with us. The poet begins by acknowledging God's authority in verse 19. You, O Lord, rule forever. This is a significant shift from how the previous generations of God's people have thought about God, have viewed God. God was to be their king, but they asked for a king, you remember? God was to be their king, but they turned to the various nations, the Assyrians and the Egyptians. God was their king, but they rejected his rule. Finally, the poet acknowledges, God, you rule. You are in charge. The poet recognizes about God what Israel always should have recognized about God, that he is king. He alone is worthy of praise and honor, and he alone has authority to restore order to the chaos that is around them. And so the poet pleads with God for restoration. Why do you forget us forever? Why do you forsake us so long? Restore us to you, O Lord, that we may be restored. Renew our days as of old. He asks God why. But it's not the kind of why we might be inclined to ask when we're suffering. He's not asking God, why have I suffered? He knows the answer to why they've suffered. He answered that in the first lament. They're suffering because of their sins. There's no question why suffering is here. Sometimes we ask God, why me, right? Why am I suffering? But that's not what the poet asks. No, he asks why. Why have you forgotten us this long? Why have you let us suffer to this point? Why haven't you yet stopped the suffering? And then he simply requests that God restore them to him. He asks God to set right Jerusalem's plight. But the book ends on an abrupt and really an odd note, doesn't it? the very last verse is puzzling. If it just ended in verse 21 with this prayer to restore us to you, O God, then that would make perfect sense to us. But it is on a really odd note, verse 22. Restore us to you unless you have utterly rejected us and are exceedingly angry with us. I don't know if you knew this. I didn't know this until I was doing some study on the book of Lamentations. Apparently, it's the custom in the synagogues when the Jews will read the various books, you know, in public, in the synagogue kind of setting. It's customary for them to read the end of the book, read 19, 20, 21, 22, and then go back and reread verse 21 because nobody wants to end on that kind of a sour note. And so they'll go back and they'll read the last verse again. In fact, they do that with a couple of books that end on pretty down notes, like Ecclesiastes, for instance, seems to end on a fairly down note. And so the rabbis and so forth, when they read that, they'll go back and read that last verse, the second to last verse again, so they don't end on that negative note. And this verse 22 is actually kind of odd, not just in the fact that it ends the book, but it's actually sort of a difficult verse to have, you know, a consistent translation with. And if you look at the various translations, how they translate it, most of the translations, at least most of the modern ones, translate it like the New American Standard does. When it says, unless you have utterly rejected us and are exceedingly angry with us, I think the NIV, the ESV, the New King James Version all translate that the same way. But the New Living Translation says, or have you utterly rejected us? Is that a question? The American Standard Version says, but thou hast utterly rejected us. The question becomes, is this a statement saying God has rejected us? Or is this a question, has God rejected us? Or is this just a possibility? Maybe God has rejected us. And all of those are reasonable translations of that sentence. The idea of a question or a possibility seems more likely than a statement. It's not getting down to the end of the book and the poet finally says, but God's rejected us anyway, so what's the point of even asking for restoration? That's not what the poet's doing. After all, why would the poet ask for restoration if he knew God had already rejected them? This isn't really a defeatist ending to this book, although it appears that way initially. It's not really suggesting that all is lost, so just don't even bother. But this last verse here in verse 22, this last phrase, coincides perfectly with what we just saw in verse 19. The poet is acknowledging God's rule and authority in all things. God, you rule. You make the rules. You get to decide who suffers and who doesn't suffer because you're a righteous judge, and we don't get a say in that. That's what the poet's finally come to realize. So God, please restore us. If you restore us, you restore us. If you reject us, you reject us. You're God. God can reject or restore whoever he pleases, as he pleases. So the poet turns and begs God for restoration. Let me make a few points from this poem, from this last lament. This last lament is entirely a prayer to God. And it's a really heartfelt prayer. It's a really open and honest prayer with God. And I think one of the things we need to remind ourselves of regularly is that prayer does work. And that prayer is worthwhile. Prayer, of course, is a theme that runs throughout the entire book of Lamentations. Every single lament, except the fourth lament, has a prayer in it. Of course, the fifth lament is entirely a prayer. However, there seems to be a hesitancy on the part of the poet to pray for relief throughout the book. There's a hesitancy on the part of the poet to ever really pray that God would restore him until he gets to the very end. God is the one imposing the suffering. Why bother asking him to relieve us from that suffering? That seems to sort of be the mindset of the poet. But the poet here, with a renewed perspective, ends up praying the very thing that he needs most. He ends up praying that God would restore him. Why? Because he's remembered in the third lament that God is merciful, that God is full of loving kindness, that he's faithful to his covenant. Please, brethren, don't neglect prayer in the midst of suffering. Maybe that should go without saying, but maybe we need to say it again. Please don't neglect prayer in the midst of your suffering. Sometimes we need to simply pray for God's attention, like he does in the first verse of chapter 5. God, remember us. God, look at and see us. But we also need to pray for restoration. We also need to put our needs on the line and tell God that this is what we need right now. We need relief. We need restoration, like he does in verse 21. After all, restoration is the very thing that God promises us if we repent and submit to him. Why should we fear praying to the God who is faithful? Why should we fear praying to the God who is full of loving kindness? Let me suggest here that in our prayers, as we pray while we're suffering, in our prayers we should petition God for mercy, like we see the poet doing here, but we should also acknowledge the severity of sin. These are two crucial elements to the suffering poet's prayer to God here in this fifth lament. Of course, his prayer for mercy is seen at the beginning and again at the end, where he says, God, remember us there in verse 1, and then down in verse 21 when he prays for restoration. That's the poet praying for mercy, that God would be merciful to him. But in the midst of all this praying for mercy, we would do well to acknowledge before our righteous and our holy God how severely we sin and what consequences we are suffering as a result for that sin. Remember, this fifth lament spends significant time relaying all the ways that Israel had fled for safety to the other nations. And may I add sort of a specific kind of point of application here. The poet does not say, God, I sinned. He says, God, I have sinned by going to the foreign nations for relief. He's very specific. He's very specific about what the suffering is that's come upon him as a result of that. Brethren, beg God for mercy, but confess your sins as much, if not more, than you pray for mercy. Enumerate your sins before God. Lay them out before him. Lament and mourn. A final observation. We can have hope through suffering and prayer. We can have hope through suffering, and we can pray confidently because God rules forever. That's the reason we can endure suffering. That's the reason we can pray even through our suffering. Because we know that God rules forever, as the poet indicates in verse 19. The idea that this book ends with a declaration of God's authority is significant for us. Sin is, by its very nature, a rejection of God's authority. It's us looking into our own lives and saying, I would rather do this than what God says. It's a rejection of God's authority. And we struggle with suffering because we don't understand God's authority. We don't understand that we've fallen short and that we've come to this point. Surely if we understood God's authority, we wouldn't violate it. But the poet recognizes something about God that helps him reconcile his own suffering in his mind. And if we can learn this truth, that God rules, that he has authority, if we can learn this truth, we can reconcile our suffering in our minds. Have you ever struggled to know why suffering? Why do good things or bad things happen to good people? Why do bad things happen to bad people? Why do bad things happen, right? Why is there suffering in the world? And how can we rectify the fact that God is sitting on his throne and not doing anything about it? These kinds of questions have plagued mankind. And I'm not sure that the book of Lamentations is designed to answer all of these kinds of questions that we may have, but it does give us one perspective through which we can find some comfort. God rules. God rules. He reigns. He is king. He always has and he always will. And as a result of that, we need to change our view of sin and suffering. Sin and suffering is not just bad things happening. Sin and suffering that results from it is a rejection of God's rule. It is a serious offense that merits serious consequences. And as a result of our understanding that God reigns and he rules, we need to lean on Him for comfort through our suffering. After all, who better to turn to than the ruler of all creation? Who better to lean on than the one who knows us so intimately? Who else can we turn to stop the suffering than the very one who is meting out the punishment that we're experiencing? I think it's an unfortunate thing that the book of Lamentations is so often overlooked. It's a small little book tucked there behind Jeremiah, and sometimes if we're lucky, if we don't run out of time in the quarter, we'll get a one lesson overview on Lamentations at the end of a study on Jeremiah or something like that. But more often than not, this little book is tucked away and it's just forgotten. And that's unfortunate, because the book contains raw emotions that are difficult to wrestle with. But these things that we find in the book of Lamentations are so immensely valuable for us today. These poems that we find in this book bring up deep truths about God, about suffering, and about our relationship with both of those things. And sometimes those things are difficult and hard to wrestle with. That the book of Lamentations describes a God who imposes suffering on His people. How can we wrestle with that? And yet they're things that we have to wrestle with. Countless people have lost their faith over these kinds of questions. If we're not wrestling with them, how are we going to answer those who doubt? But above all, this book serves as a guidebook. These poems serve as a guide to help us navigate suffering in our lives. Not how to overcome suffering. In fact, it doesn't tell us anything about how to come out of suffering. It tells us how to suffer. It helps us to understand where suffering comes from, and it gives us tools to overcome that suffering. I hope that I haven't utterly depressed everyone with this series on Lamentations, but I hope that it's been helpful to you. I hope that it's provided a perspective for you that maybe we don't always consider. Maybe we don't always think about simply because it's uncomfortable to think about. But the fact is, suffering is real, and suffering is painful. But as we see over and over and over and over in the book of Lamentations, suffering is ultimately a result of sin. And the true hope to overcome suffering is to defeat sin. That's how we overcome suffering, by defeating the very cause of suffering in our lives. And thanks be to God that He's provided a way to do that. Thanks be to God that He gave His Son, who died on a cross, rose from the dead, conquering death, overcoming sin, and invites us to share with Him in that. And if there's any way that we can help you understand how to access the hope that Jesus Christ provides to those who suffer, then we want to make an opportunity right now for you to come and to make those needs known. If we can help you, why don't you come and let us know what we can do as we stand and as we sing a song of encouragement.